From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
For the first time since the Red Cars, a train from Culver City to downtown LA. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. West Side commuters are getting their first chance to take rapid transit all the way downtown. But what about getting from home to the station and back, and access to parking? L.A. County's elected assessor denies doing favors for campaign contributors. We'll hear about investigations of possible bribery and campaign money laundering. And how about them Clippers? Later on, L.A. since the Rodney King riots, what can it show the rest of the country? First, here's the news. We're Manali back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. It's been 20 years since the Rodney King riots. What are the lessons for the rest of America then and now? We'll have more on that later on tonight. First, this story. After a weekend of free rides from the west side to downtown and back, the new Expo line opened today for paying commuters. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez was at the La Cienega Jefferson Station, the Expo line's furthest point west so far.
What's your name?
Larissi Angelo.
Larissi, we're here at the La Cienega and Jefferson stop. Where are you going this morning?
Downtown, actually. It's perfect. Now I just leave my car parked at home, so.
So this will be good for you?
Yeah, it will be.
Explain that. I mean, how so, exactly?
Well, I don't have to park, and parking's, like, expensive, or you park, like, 3-4 blocks away, and you still pay for parking, and it's actually more than paying for the fare for the train, so. I mean, I definitely still have my car for weekends, but for work, it's perfect to just hop on the train.
What's your name?
Joseph.
Joseph.
Expo.
How are you going to be using Expo Line on its first day?
Okay, well, instead of taking the bus, I'm going to take the train, get there a little faster. It's a longer walk to get to this main street, but it gets a faster ride to get to school.
And is it something you could see using every day or once a week? Or?
Yeah, definitely. And not just using it once a week just to get to school, but to other places too.
What's your name, sir?
Ron Riley.
Ron Riley, what brings you here today? Obviously, you're trying to get from point A to point B, but where are you going exactly?
Downtown.
And why did you pick Expo Line?
Well, actually, I'm just testing to see because I always drive from, I live in View Park and I drive downtown. So this is kind of like a good alternative because I can save a lot of gas because I'm right down the street from here. And so the train transfers to the red line, which is by Pershing Square, which I can walk right up to work.
But today is your experiment day. You're going to see if this is going to work out.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure it is. I mean, I think as long as it doesn't break down, I'm okay.
What's your name, sir?
Tony Jones.
We're at the La Cienega in Jefferson Station. You're coming from where?
Western Exposition.
And how was your first ride for work?
It was pretty fast and comfortable, smooth.
Will you be doing it every day, do you think, or just from time to time?
Well, time to time, to save gas.
What are the advantages of it?
Exercise, saving money on gas, and I get up early quite a bit, so that, it's convenient.
Okay, some fairly enthusiastic first-day riders. Last Wednesday on Which Way LA, Rochelle Mills told us she was eagerly anticipating the Expo line. She's an architectural designer in the Crenshaw District, a Planning Commission and Design Review Board member, and she lives 3 blocks from the nearest station. Good to have you back on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, did you take a ride yesterday?
I did. It was something my husband and I anticipated, so we got on early, rode to the end, La Cienega. Then we decided to ride to the other end and go out for breakfast downtown.
So how long did all that take you?
It didn't take much time at all. I think the hardest part was realizing that we're so out of shape that the walk was killing us.
Three
but
blocks?
On the way back, I noticed that my husband commented that he had never been to the museums in Expo Park. And so it was so convenient to get off and take a stroll through the gardens and then the Science Center and then look at the exhibits at the History Museum.
So this is something then that you can take advantage of not just during the weekday but on weekends as well.
Absolutely. I think it was great seeing so many families riding the train both ways. I thought it was wonderful.
Was it pretty comfortable?
It was comfortable. It was comfortable and quick, just like what all of the others were saying.
What about that walk you mentioned? You said you're out of shape. Do you think you're going to get in better shape, or are you going to figure out another way to get there?
No, you know, it was a good walk, because by the time I was too tired, the train would come, and so I'd have some relief. I think it was a great opportunity. Three blocks, mentally it sounds pretty close, but when you're so used to being in the car all the time, you don't realize how much you're missing. So the walk would do me good.
Any complaints?
Not one.
Okay, Rochelle Mills. Farouk Amin is an urban designer and principal of City Design Studio. His clients include Metro. He is involved with station area planning for 8 proposed stations on the Crenshaw line, which is going to serve Inglewood. It'll start construction next year. Farouk Amin, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
Well, what about this question of what happens at the end and at the beginning of the line, the so-called first and last mile?
Yes, the first and last mile issue is something I believe that transportation planners and public agencies are just beginning to recognize in a sort of an aggressive way. Really, the first mile, last mile issue is how do you get to the station from where you live or where you reside? And once you get on the train at one end, what happens when you get off at the other end? It is convenient if you happen to have a car and if you happen to find parking next to the station when you're driving to the station. But then again, what would you do once you've taken your train ride, gotten off at the other end, and you need to go somewhere? In other words, the last mile. And that is, the first mile and the last mile are probably sort of the biggest issues today, because it is really a great opportunity to have a line such as Expo come in. But then if, for example, you happen not to be going downtown, but you happen to be going, say, to from say, Culver City to Expo in Vermont, and you happen to be working perhaps a longer walk than you wanted to walk, greater than 10 minutes, what would you do? Would you be able to take a bus? Would there be a shuttle? Would you happen to be carrying, a bike on the train? And really, what we have in the city of L.A. are some great plans for lines that will connect nodes of activity, whether it's work or sort of a center of a big population that live in a certain area. But the question is, what happens, when you arrive at your destination, and also what happens if you need to get to your destination without actually driving a car?
Let me go back to Rochelle Mills. Would you like, for example, to have a shuttle to take you those 3 blocks?
No, actually, it was a great opportunity to get to see some neighbors, to see some of the storefronts that I take for granted and whiz by, just like I mentioned with my husband in the museum. He's been here 25 years. We say we'll go see it one day, and we, 25 years later, never have. I think what's so great about the Expo line, with the exception of downtown, all of the stops are at major intersections where there is transportation. And all of the park and ride areas are free with the minimal cost for reserved parking. So unless you are just determined to walk very far, adding a bike would just enhance the commute.
Farouk Amin, what about situations where people don't have cars and may live some distance away, for example, from the terminus nearest their home, and it's dark and dangerous?
Yes, it is. It is a big issue. There are other cities in not necessarily in the United States. The city of Curitiba in Brazil, for example, has probably one of the most phenomenal transit networks. And they've focused not only on the primary networks, which is the equivalent of the light rail in Los Angeles, but they also have a secondary and then a tertiary network. And so you're actually able to go from wherever you live to wherever you want to be, whether it's a place of work or a destination such as a museum and so forth. And you actually have access all the way through. And I believe, once the focus, once we have expended our energies, or even while we're expending all our energies and our resources on these major routes, we need to be looking at, you know, what those secondary and tertiary modes of transportation are. Even for myself, I do have a car. I do drive to the nearest Gold Line station, park my car when I can find parking, and then take the train into downtown. I remember trying to do this by not actually using my car, and it would treble my transit time. So although I enjoy the possibility of being on the light rail and enjoy the speed and the facility and the comfort of that, actually getting to the light rail system itself is a big issue for me.
Again, Farouk Amin, you're saying once again the first and last mile can be crucial. Perhaps we need secondary and even tertiary efforts to get people from their homes to wherever it is they are going and back. Thank you both. We'll hear more about the Expo Line and other transportation issues from both of you, I'm sure. Farouk Amin at City Design Studio and Rochelle Mills in the Crenshaw District. Thanks to you both. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/whichwayla or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman, I'll be back with Which Way LA. The district attorney's office last week served search warrants in 12 locations, including the home of LA County's elected tax assessor, John Nogues, and the home of a tax agent in Phoenix. His name is Ramin Salari. No charges have been filed yet, but Jean Mattis is writing for the LA Weekly about possible money laundering and bribery. Jean Mattis, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about what a tax agent is. That seems to have a lot to do with this.
A tax agent is somebody that you might hire to get your property taxes lowered. Basically what the assessor's office does is determines what every parcel of property in the county is worth. If you think your property is assessed at too high a value and your taxes are too high, you could hire a tax agent to go and lobby them and argue that, in fact, it ought to be lower. So that's what a tax agent does.
And this is an unregulated profession?
Yes, it's totally unregulated. You don't have to get a license to do it. There's no licensing board or anything like that. It's not like being a lawyer. It's not like being a nurse practitioner or anything like that. It's just, you know, anybody can hang out a shingle and do it. And so it's kind of a freewheeling, Wild West kind of occupation.
And you have reported that there may be some rather interesting connections between tax agents and appraisers who work for the assessor. What are some of the things they're doing?
Well, there's a connection between this particular tax agent we're talking about, Ramin Salari, and a particular appraiser, Scott Schenter, who was on his way to being fired about a year ago when he resigned. And what he was apparently doing was lowering people's property values without any authority to do that, any permission to do it, and without doing any work, actually. And so a large number of those properties, we're talking about 150 properties, a large number of those were represented by this tax agent, Ramin Salari. And so when the assessor's office went to ask him, why did you do this? He said, I did it because John Nogues told me to. So, it's potentially quite an explosive thing over there.
And I take it that Salari and some of the people whose values were lowered are people who have contributed to Nogues' campaign.
Right. So essentially, our understanding is basically that Schenter did this, lowered these property values in hopes that the people who got those lowered values would reward the Noguez campaign for his generosity by making campaign contributions. And, you know, that's where we get into a pay-to-play scenario, which is, you know, potentially illegal.
So Scott Chenter is a person who was working for the assessor's office as an appraiser. Ramin Saleri is somebody who was working as a tax agent on his own representing homeowners. And John Noguez is the elected tax assessor. Did Noguez have relationships, close relationships with both Chenter and Saleri?
He did. You know, Noguez is a very sociable guy, a very friendly guy, and he has pretty long-standing relationships with both Saleri and Chenter. We found, for instance, that Saleri had contributed $15,000 to two of Noguez's allies on the Huntington Park City Council back in 2003. So we're talking about a long history of this kind of campaign contribution behavior. And with Chenter, there's, you know, quite a lot of records of them socializing, going out, going to a concert, going to a Super Bowl party together and stuff like that. So it's certainly plausible that, you know, Chenter and Noguez could have, you know, been involved in something like this. And certainly that's the allegation. I mean, these guys were certainly friends. And, you know, Noguez now is downplaying any connection he might have had with Chenter, but it seems pretty clear that they were at least tight up until the point when Chenter quit the office.
They all seem now to be saying nasty things about one another, according to your stories in the L.A. Weekly. What about the idea of being a defender of the role as opposed to somebody who's somewhat more flexible?
This is one of the more interesting concepts that came across in covering this. A defender of the role, it sort of sounds like this noble, heroic thing, but it's actually an insult in the office. And essentially what it means is, you know, an appraiser who will defend a high appraisal value regardless of whether the facts back him up. It's sort of an accusation that's made against people that, oh, that guy's a defender of the role. That means he won't, you know, he won't work with the taxpayer to get to the true fair market value. And there's been a sort of long progression over the last several decades, really, of sort of trying to stamp that impulse out and to say, we're not going to be defenders of the role. We're going to be more taxpayer friendly here. We're going to work collaboratively with taxpayers and with tax agents to find what the fair market value is. And we're not going to take an oppositional, confrontational approach to it. We are going to be collaborative and open and friendly and all of that. And so I think what we're seeing with this Chenter case is sort of that impulse, that sort of let's be friends with these folks impulse, taken to a pretty extreme point where you're basically just doing favors for your friends. And so it can go too far in that direction, and it seems like part of what needs to happen here is for the pendulum to swing back a little bit and for it to be more of a defender of the role kind of thing would be sort of a corrective measure at this point.
Could you end up costing the county quite a lot of money? And as you point out in your piece, very importantly, it seems to me, appraisal is a matter of opinion.
Yeah, that's one of the things they said to me, the people who work in this field, is that property tax is the only form of tax that's based on an opinion. And that means that it's susceptible to influence, you know. And so one of the concerns is that tax agents rather routinely make campaign contributions to assessors, and they encourage their clients to make campaign contributions to assessors. And, you know, you might argue, okay, well, that's what you have to do to get elected, and it doesn't affect what I do, which is what they would argue. But, you know, campaign contributions influence people. That's why they get made. So, you know, there's potentially a problem there that ought to be corrected as well.
And when people go to the polls and vote for the assessor, very seldom, it seems to me, do they really know who they're voting for or even why the tax assessor is elected. The Los Angeles Times raises that question in an editorial today. Well, we'll hear more about this for sure. No charges have been filed as yet, but the district attorney's office is, has filed 12 search warrants, including one on Assessor Noguez's home, suggests they're pretty serious.
Yeah, they've been looking at the Chenter stuff for more than a year now, and they've been looking at, specifically at Noguez and at Ramin Saleri for about the last 6 months or so. So, you know, we could see something, you know, in the next few months or something like that.
Gene Mattis, staff writer for the LA Weekly. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. Last night in Memphis, Tennessee, the LA Clippers were behind the Grizzlies by 24 points with 9 minutes remaining. The first game of the first round of the NBA playoffs looked like a snooze. And then something amazing happened.
Here is Rudy Gay, fires it up. Short, taken down by Griffin, and the Clippers have won it.
After a run of 26 points to 1, the Clippers managed a one-point victory. Jill Painter was there for the Daily News. Jill, have you ever seen anything like that before?
No, it was such a stunner. I mean, a lot of us had our heads buried in our laptops writing about how awful the Clippers were for a while, and you look up and they've, you know, kept cutting it the lead down, and then all of a sudden Nick Young makes 3 three-pointers in a row, and they're down by 3 points, and they win, and it's still just incredible to try and figure out what happened. It's just for a team to come back. They were down 27 points in the game and 24 with 9 minutes to go. It's just that stuff just doesn't happen on the road in the playoffs.
And you mentioned 3 straight 3-pointers by Nick Young. Is he somebody who's been coming through for them all year?
Well, he actually was a new addition this year. He went to USC. He's a local boy. Played at Cleveland of Reseda, and he was involved in one of the trades of the Clippers. So he actually has just kind of been trying to find his way. He hasn't been with the team that long, just a few months, but he's certainly made a big impact, and they needed that. You know, Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, the two superstars, were struggling for 3 periods, so somebody had to do something and give him a spark, and for some reason this team is kind of their MO this year. You know, they just kind of stink up the joint for three periods and 3 quarters, and then all of a sudden they get going in the fourth quarter.
Well, are the Grizzlies great on defense? Is that why Paul and Griffin weren't able to do better?
Great on defense. I mean, they were solid for sure. I just think it was a lot of nerves. Blake Griffin was playing in his first career playoff game, and he definitely looked nervous. Chris Paul has this groin injury, and we don't know how effective he is. So I don't know that it was so much the Grizzlies' defense, which, again, they're a pretty good defensive team. But, you know, the Clippers were just missing so many shots and, you know, open looks that they should have been knocking down. So I think it was a lot of the Clippers' poor play, and then Memphis was making every shot in sight for 3 quarters, and they weren't doing that in the fourth.
What was the reaction of the crowd when the Clippers won the game?
You know, what was really interesting is I was about there for about 10 minutes afterwards, maddeningly typing on my computer, and I kept looking up a few times, and there were so many people that were still there just sitting there stunned. I mean, they didn't want to leave the arena. They were showing interviews of the coaches on the big screen, and some fans were booing. As you know, it was as though if they didn't leave their seat, they could somehow change the outcome of the game. But, you know, right afterwards, it was unbelievably quiet. It was quiet for a lot of the fourth quarter, and let me tell you, that building was rocking for most of that game, you know, with the Beat LA chants, and I don't know that I've ever heard Staples Center as loud as it was in Memphis. These people are really into this Grizzlies playoff run, and they were stunned.
Are the Grizzlies expected, or the Grizzlies, I guess, were expected to win? Does this change things?
I don't think it does change the series, and unless Memphis is so brokenhearted and, you know, down mentally that they can't get back in this. But Memphis is a team that even the Lakers didn't want to play. They wanted to make sure they got that number 3 seed, so they didn't have to play Memphis. Memphis is kind of viewed as that scary team nobody wants to play. So, you know, I think that they still have, I mean, Marc Gasol and Rudy Gay, who, you know, his final shot at the buzzer just went off the rim. If that goes in, then, you know, they win game one. But they still have all the tools, I think Memphis does, to win this series. And not only that, Clippers lost Caron Butler to a left fractured his hand in the game yesterday, and he's likely out for the rest of the playoffs. So, you know, I think this was just one improbable win, and Memphis will still win the series. But, you know, hey, they did what they did yesterday, so who knows?
What about that other team here in Los Angeles? How are they doing?
Lakers, Dodgers, Kings? Which one are you talking about? Everybody's doing well. No, the Lakers. Lakers obviously had a very good start to their playoff series. I mean, they really drilled Denver. And when Bynum is playing like that with a triple double and blocks and rebounds, he's doing everything. He's so active, playing defense, which he even said it. Note to self, if I play defense, we'll win. You know, they looked really good and maybe a lot better than a lot of us would have envisioned. But all the teams in L.A. are doing well. You have the Kings winning Game 1 against St. Louis in St. Louis. Dodgers doing well with Matt Kemp. It's a good time to be an L.A. sports fan.
And the Kings, as you mentioned, are doing fine as well. They won, too.
They did. They won 3-1 at St. Louis here in Game 1. And it's funny, both of these teams have problems scoring and good goaltending, so everybody's sort of seeing this as a, you know, goaltending series, 1-0, you know, 2-1 kind of games, which beside an empty netter the other night, it really was, and L.A. kind of send a St. Louis, I think, when you have home ice, and the way St. Louis has played at home all year, I think they won 30 games. I mean, they were just unbeatable at home, so for L.A. to come in and steal at least one of those games and, you know, maybe another one tonight, they're going beyond expectations. It's a team that limped into the playoffs, beat the number one seed in the Western Conference in Vancouver, and now they're up game one on St. Louis.
So very quickly, when's the next game in Memphis?
Next game in Memphis is not till Wednesday, so the Clippers have a few days to kind of rest on that amazing win and try and figure out what the heck happened. I think Blake Griffin sure looked shocked still long after the game as he was trying to put it into words. So they play on Wednesday night in Memphis, and then they'll come back to L.A. for a Saturday game.
Okay, Jill Painter with the L.A. Daily News. Have fun. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Take care.
Okay. You can join the conversation on our Which Way L.A. Facebook page. In a moment, Los Angeles since the Rodney King riots. What can it show the rest of the country on Which Way L.A.? Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. A recent conference 20 years after the Rodney King riots was called Los Angeles, America Only Sooner. In a moment, we'll hear some of the lessons the rest of the country can learn. First, here's John Singleton, whose film Boys in the Hood was claimed by some to have predicted what happened.
The interesting thing when people talk about the 1992 riots that I'm really, really interested in is the psychological implications of race and economics in this country. I feel that uprising was as much an economic out thing, you know, like kind of uprising as much as it was a race, you know what I mean? Because it's interesting, race plays a part in so many different things about how the media portrayed the actual skirmish and stuff. You know, they made it more of a black outlash thing when most of the people that I feel were rioting were not black, they were of color. But they were mostly Latino, you know, and they were people who had grown up not just in Mexico but in El Salvador and in Central America, and war-torn countries, who were used to that type of mayhem. Interesting enough, but no one, you know, when you see the media and even now when you see footage 20 years later about it, they make it more of a black thing. That was probably the powder keg of it in terms of Rodney King being assaulted by the LAPD. That was the crux of what. And then the police getting off, that was the crux of what started things, but it was transferred. You know, there was, as I say, all energy doesn't just dissipate. You know, if you put out energy, it's going to be transferred in some way. So, I mean, that's the stuff that I'm really interested in. It's like, you know, it's amazing because once this happened, everybody was unified within their rage of their own situation, not only with the significance of their own life in terms of what the police were capable of doing, but also like, we don't have nothing. You know what I mean? So the attitude was like, we have nothing, so we have nothing to lose.
The Reverend Cecil Murray was pastor of the First AME Church with 18,000 members, a kind of headquarters for LA's black establishment. Why did people participate in destroying their own neighborhoods?
Isn't that a good question? I think it has to do with the explosion of a dream. Langston Hughes, the black poet, asks, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or does it explode? I think history speaks. It explodes. if you take your hand and keep pressing a person down, 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 sooner or later, the explosion will occur. And I think that's what happened that night.
TV and film actress Anna Deavere Smith interviewed some 300 people after the riot, and she portrayed 40 of them in a one-woman show called Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992.
I came here as a East Coast girl, in many ways a Southern girl, growing up in Baltimore. Think about black people and white people. So how I grew up, if somebody was the rare occasion of an Asian American, we had to sort of almost place them as black because they were not white. So many of us grew up in a time of other than white was black. And so to come here, really, this was just an explosion for me of diversity. And even in many of the sort of panels and stuff that I ended up on after the play, which actually ran in 93 here, 94 on Broadway, I was always trying to argue with black men in particular who wanted to still claim that as a black-white story. Very, very brilliant African-American men. But to me, having been here and interviewed all these people, it was much more than a black-white story. And it was giving us as a nation an opportunity to see how complicated race is. And sort of in universities, people have been studying that and know how complex it is. So to me, if there was anything that was of value about this explosion, it's like the doors blew open and we really saw that our race story is much bigger than a black and white story.
20 years after the Rodney King riots, residents say the city is safer and that relations between blacks and Hispanics and Korean Americans and whites are significantly better. That's according to a survey by the Center for the Study of Los Angeles, an institution that emerged from the Troubles of 1992. The center is at Loyola Marymount University, and Professor Fernando Guerra is the executive director. Always good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Warren.
Tell us a bit about what you discovered in your survey, particularly as it reflects on what we just heard from Anna Deavere Smith, that the race story is much bigger than a black and white story, certainly in Los Angeles, perhaps around the country as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Los Angeles is at the forefront of a multicultural city. I don't think there's any city in the world that is more multicultural. And that could be measured in terms of no city has groups of 500,000 or more from so many different origins like Los Angeles. And, you know, the narrative has constantly been about not only the riots, but how race relations unfold in L.A. and the United States about a white black relationship when it's much more complicated than that. And we have found in our surveys, this is the fourth in a series of surveys. We did one 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and now 20 years after the riots, where we've asked some of the same questions, including how are our races getting along, our racial groups getting along in Los Angeles. And you see constant improvement in terms of the opinion of Angelenos, feeling that everybody's getting along a lot more than they were in the past.
We heard so much about immigrants and about the American dream being exploded in various ways. How do you account for this improvement? Are people just getting to know each other better?
Yeah, I mean, Los Angeles is still segregated. I don't want to, mislead anybody. The majority of whites, blacks, Latinos, and Asians still live in neighborhoods that are the same group. However, that's lessened somewhat. I think of the major cities, Los Angeles is probably one of the least segregated. In addition, we've increased so many new multicultural neighborhoods that we didn't have before. The best example, of course, is downtown Los Angeles that has almost doubled in size since the riots, and it is exactly, according to the 2010 census, 25% white, 25% Asian, 25% Latino, and 25% African American, a perfect multicultural mix for the city of Los Angeles. And so, and not only are there now close to 50,000 people in downtown with this multicultural mix, you know, just about every day because it's a cultural center with the Disney Hall and Staples Center and all kinds of different activities going on downtown, we have, and it's an employment center. So every single day, 500,000 people come into this multicultural neighborhood with many multicultural interactions, all of them very positive and constructive in terms of employment, in terms of entertainment, et cetera. that I think that's made a positive impact.
And Charlie Beck, the current chief of police, whom we heard earlier in our program, says that crime is down by it's a fourth of what it was in 1992, and that includes violent crimes, drug crimes, all kinds of crimes.
And not only do we have the objective data, but we also have the opinion of Angelenos, who strongly believe that crime is down. They perceive themselves to be safer than they were 20 years ago. They perceive crime to be lower than it was 20 years ago. They perceive gang activity to be much lower than it was 20 years ago. So along all those metrics, people perceive that to be a much better situation.
Manuel Pastor is a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. It's good to have you on our program.
Glad to be with you.
Pick it up where Fernando Guerra with the Center for the Study of Los Angeles just left off. And tell us more about the movement of the various ethnic and national groups of people that now are crowding into Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, I mean, think first, looping back to what starts this conversation, it's important to understand that there were really three riots in the days of 1992. One was a kind of political protest against the police that happened at Parker Center, the police headquarters in downtown Los Angeles, and spilled through downtown L.A. The second was the racialized violence that exploded at Florence and Normandy with the famous pictures of the white trucker Reginald Denny and others being pulled out of their vehicles. And the third, as John Singleton said, was really an economic riot, the sort of looting and arson that spread all over the city. And as a result, if you looked at the pattern of that, it was really much more connected to economic issues. We've done a pretty good job on addressing some of the issues of the first riot. The police department has been really dramatically transformed. We've built much better relationships between groups dealing with that second kind of riot. We wind up coming up very short on having made significant economic progress. South LA and other neighborhoods remain marked by very high levels of unemployment, very low levels of income, and significant lack of job opportunity. But we have made progress on bringing people together, not just residentially, as Fernando Guerra is pointing out, but also there's been a vibrant kind of social movement infrastructure that's emerged in the city to try to work on these issues of economic injustice, and they've been able to bring people together across geographic lines to work together on common cause, like a living wage law or community benefits agreements or improving their neighborhoods.
The economy, though, is not just as bad as it was. In some respects, it's worse. There's higher unemployment right now, and the companies that had left the area and taken jobs with them have not returned or been replaced.
No, I think in some ways the economy is a lot worse. So I think one of the questions is, why are we not erupting in violence once again? I think that there's a couple of different reasons that explain that. One is that in 1992, Los Angeles was suffering the brunt of California's recession, and California was suffering the brunt of the United States recession, partly because that recession in the early 1990s was triggered by a fall in defense spending, very heavy impacts on California, very heavy impacts on Los Angeles, and very unequal impacts within Los Angeles. L.A. is suffering now, but L.A. is suffering much like the rest of the country. I think the second thing is that there really has been a lot of vibrant community organizing. If you put together economic dislocation with social disconnection, you've really got a recipe for the kind of violence that occurred. We have a lot of economic dislocation, but there's a lot of community organizing groups that are tying people together and weaving the kind of social fabric that helps to keep the peace. You know, the police have done a better job, and that's part of the reason why crime is down. But these community organizations have also done a better job of making sure that people in the neighborhoods have their own eyes on the street and that they feel much more part of the neighborhoods in a way which also helps keep crime down.
Manuel Pastor at the University of Southern California. Angela Glover Blackwell is founder and chief executive officer of Policy Link, a national research and action institute advancing economic and social equity. She's not in Los Angeles. She's up in the San Francisco Bay area, but she has been dealing with these issues for a very long time. Angela Glover Blackwell, it's good to have you on our program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Do you think that there has been, as our other guests have suggested, a real change in the way in which ethnicities relate to one another, different ethnicities, over time once they get together and once they've been there. And do community organizations of the kind that Professor Pastore described have a real place and function?
Yes, they do have a very important place and function, and I always point to Los Angeles when I'm trying to make the point around the country that communities of color are really working together in fantastic ways in Los Angeles and setting the pace and the bar for the nation around this. And it comes at a very timely moment because people of color are becoming the majority in the nation already. Over 46% of all children under 18 are of color. Half will be by the end of this decade. And by 2040 or so, the majority of people in the nation will be of color. So it is very good that we have examples of groups coming together in positive ways to see their common interests, work on their common issues, and begin to see themselves as setting the pace and the possibility for the nation. Because as you look at these changing demographics, it's clear that what happens to people of color will determine what happens to the nation for decades and decades to come. But listening to the description about for Manuel about the three uprisings that happened and the economic one being the one that has not yet been addressed, that's what I see across the country. The issues of education, transportation, employment, incarceration, and housing continue to be huge issues in metropolitan areas across the country, and at the moment the news is not good from any one of them.
Let me go back to Fernando Guerra again with a poll by the Center for the Study of Los Angeles. What do you find here with regard to education and transportation, incarceration also mentioned by Ms. Blackwell, and housing? Were you able to poll to that depth?
Yeah, we did ask people how they felt if there was progress in the direction of the city and then progress in those particular areas. And I think the major finding for us is while people were somewhat pessimistic about the city and the direction that the city was going, they were very positive about race relations and they were very positive about another riot not happening. So there's a de-linking, almost a de-racialization of the pessimism and optimism, and pessimism not being driven by race or crime, but being driven by the economy and housing and those issues. And so people, and then when we ask specifically about specific areas such as transportation and those, we have all those all that data, and it's all on our website, and it's very extensive in terms of what they think about the environment, crime, jobs, healthcare, traffic, public education.
Let me go back to Angela Glover Blackwell. I would gather from what you've said that perhaps other cities, as they become more solidly minorities, as we call it now, people of color in the moving into majorities, they may not have to have a riot. On the other hand, the kinds of concerns you raise, education, transportation, incarceration, and housing, are pretty basic.
They're pretty basic, and the nation needs to wake up to the fact that if it wants to be strong in the future in terms of being competitive in the global economy, having a vibrant democracy, having a country in which we actually feel that the middle class will continue to define what's been great about America, we have to start thinking differently about what's happening to low-income people of color. Nationally, 84% of black children and 83% of Latino children are not proficient at fourth grade reading. Nationally, we have the most incarceration in the whole world with 2.3 million people currently in the nation's prisons. Over 60% are of racial and ethnic groups. And if current trends continue, 1 in 3 African-American males and 1 in 6 Latino males can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. And we worry so much about a nation when we get above double-digit unemployment, 10.3% of Latinos, 14% of African-Americans in the March 2012 unemployment figures are unemployed. And so nationally, we have not just these issues, but a suburbanization of poverty. We always ask what's happening in cities, but we now have more poor poor people in the suburbs and in cities. The proportions are larger in cities, but the sheer number is more in the suburbs. And we don't even have a plan as a nation for how to help people be able to achieve what they sought when they moved to these suburban areas, which was to improve opportunity for themselves and their children. And so I am so happy that we are improving race relations, particularly among groups of color, and pleased that we haven't seen a rise in crime. We need to take advantage of the positives that are happening in communities to do something about the negatives that are not only bad for people of color, but will begin to define this nation as we become a majority nation in which the majority of people are people of color.
Angela Glover Blackwell, again, founder and chief executive officer of Policy Link. Manuel Pastor, back to you at the University of Southern California. What about the suburbanization of poverty? What about the intermixing of these various groups? And if, in fact, they are deprived in as many ways as we're hearing, is there a possibility that they might begin to turn hostile to one another again in competition over jobs, for example?
Well, the suburbanization of poverty is an ongoing, and the suburbanization of groups of color is an ongoing phenomenon. One of the reasons why it presents particular challenges is a lot of the suburban jurisdictions don't have either the social service infrastructure or the community organizing infrastructure to service the communities or to provide voice so that people can begin to demand those services. But I think Angela's right to raise us to take a look at the national picture. You know, if you think about what was going on in Los Angeles in 1992, there had been a study put out right prior to the unrest called The Widening Divide, looking at the growing gap between the rich and the poor. We had a set of bubbling racial tensions kind of emerging in every direction that led to unease between groups. We had a sort of a police state in which the police were viewed as an occupying army, and there was a kind of epidemic of over-incarceration. And we had polarized politics within Los Angeles in which the mayor was not talking to the police chief, in which groups were in different camps, in which it was hard to make a decision to be able to move forward. It sounds a little bit like America today, the kind of economic inequality, the bubbling racial tensions, the issues with over-incarceration, and the polarized politics which are preventing us from moving forward. I don't think the United States is going to blow up with the kind of conflagration that happened here in Los Angeles in 1992. But what it does point out is that the kinds of social movement organizing that built the community organizations to tie the groups together so that they can have a more optimistic sense of what the race relations are between groups, and that provides the platform for beginning to transform the economy, that's something very important that we need to do at a national level as well.
Ms. Blackwell, how do you get people to focus on community organizing and social services when they feel, and rightly so, that they are being deprived of what other citizens have?
You know, we are really not a poor country, and we need to stop acting like one. We have defined ourselves as not having the resources to deal with what we need. But the truth of the matter is, if we would deal with our tax policy, if we would get more engaged in making sure that the institutions that have helped California be strong in the past could help be strong in the future, we could get out of this. There are over 700,000 millionaires in the state of California alone. But what we probably will need to do is overcome our racial divide, because our racial divide in America is becoming a generational divide. If we become a nation in which the young are of color and the old are more likely to be white, we find ourselves at a point where the lack of connection that we have felt across race is going to hurt us as a nation.
What about I'm sorry for interrupting you, but what about the anti-immigrant issues that we see being raised around the country? How do you see that playing into the future?
It's a huge problem, because we see that as immigration slows down, that it reflects that the economy is slowing down. We ought to welcome immigrants, and we ought to understand that if we have a country that is producing, that's a place that people want to come. This anti-immigration notion really comes out of people being afraid, leaders not explaining what's really going on. And one of the things that's so good about the cross-race, cross-ethnic work that is happening there is we see many people who are black supporting the immigration issues. We see many people who are Latino speaking coming out about the incarceration issues that are so hurting the black community. So we're seeing progress in places like Los Angeles, but as a nation, our leaders have not helped us to understand.
Manuel Pastor, finally back to you. What do you think the rest of the country can learn most from Los Angeles? Is it this issue of social services and community organizing? Excuse me.
You know, this week the Council on Foundations, which is a set of philanthropic organizations in the country, is meeting here in L.A., and there's a wonderful little pamphlet that's put out that is says, Los Angeles, America, only sooner. And, you know, that's really absolutely the case. I mean, in fact, Los Angeles is the only metropolitan area in the United States in the last 10 years, big metro area, that did not see an increase in the number of Hispanic children. Our sort of demographic changes have kind of come to a stasis very close to where the United States is going to be 40 or 50 years from now. And what do we find? I mean, there's anti-immigrant sentiment here, but it's really not that strong. Do we find African-Americans and Latinos getting along? We find whites who are in the city able to get along with other groups as well. And while we haven't made as much progress in the economy, there's a growing consciousness that we need to make this progress because the future of this metropolitan region depends on these young people that Angela's talking about. 2/3 of our children have at least one immigrant parent. 90% of those kids born in the United States. How they do and how their parents do is going to determine the future of the Los Angeles metropolitan region. And what we're beginning to find is not just civic leaders, not just community activists, not just movement activists, but also business people are beginning to realize that the kind of investments we make now in these young people determine the future of the Los Angeles economy. We need to kind of create that consciousness at a national level. Okay. And we're going to do that by reconnecting in exactly the ways that Angela was talking about.
Los Angeles, America only sooner. Worth remembering. Manuel Pastor at the University of California, Angela Glover-Blackwell at Policy Link, Fernando Guerra at the Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. That's all the time we have for this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can visit the Which Way LA blog for even more stories about Los Angeles at kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.